Kevin Mahoney. Welcome to The Sit Down. I am the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The Sit Down is the latest addition to our Raging Chicken radio podcast. And on The Sit Down, we talk to activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and rabble rousers of all sorts to deepen our discussions and prepare us for the struggles ahead. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things you can do to help support this podcast and all the work that we do with Raging Chicken. If you want to help out a progressive activist media network for PA and beyond, you can become a member for as little as $2 a month. $2, folks. That's less than the cost of a beer or a cup of coffee. Go to the RagingChickenPress.org and click Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. And if you're listening on Podbean, just click Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts for each membership level while you're there. Today on The Sit Down, we'll be talking to Paul Ricci. Paul does some really cool blogging over at CSI Without Dead Bodies. What you say? Yeah, that's right. CSI Without Dead Bodies. And here's how he explains it on his blog. Quote, "My occupation is a statistician. I tell people it's like CSI without dead bodies because examining a set of data that has been collected is like doing an autopsy on a deceased person in the sense that I'm trying to learn what I can from the information available. Except in this case, the information does not involve gross things. For me, the process can be humorous, scary, but always captivating. I hope you feel the same way too." Paul is a statistical consultant at Duquesne University and is the statistical outreach director for Healthcare for All PA. Paul is a native of Johnstown, PA, and is doing great work organizing in an area of the state left behind by mainstream progressive politics. But as we've been saying on here on Raging Chicken Radio, areas like Johnstown, PA, and Cambria County, PA, are exactly where progressives should be organizing. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time, and welcome to Raging Chicken Radio as a sit-down.
Thank you. Nice to see you, too.
Yeah, it's great to see you. I've kind of been following your work for a while online, and it's great to actually see you face-to-face. So this CSI Without Dead Bodies, I mean, you know, what are you getting at here? Like, what? Talk to us a little bit about this approach to this blog and why you're doing what you're doing.
Okay. I mean, you know, my mother was a big fan of the show CSI, and she... You know, they always did a good job using inductive and deductive reasoning to start with, you know, this dead body and, you know, to, you know, and then follow the logical steps to find the criminal, you know, and sometimes they made errors, sometimes they didn't. But, you know, I mean, I thought I'm just trying to decouple the investigative process, you know, from this fascination with morbid things like a dead body. So that's why, you know, I mean, I suppose I could have called it SVU, Law and Order SVU without the sex crimes.
Well, you know, I guess that would
basically be a dating show, but you know, the investigative part can still be fascinating without the gross part.
Right. No. And I think that, I mean, that whole idea that looking at data to kind of tease out narratives, to try to tease out the stories about what's going on here, what happened is absolutely fascinating. So, you know, one of the things that I'm especially interested in following the work that you've been doing, because, you know, not only are you kind of tracking data on this kind of like larger level, but you're kind of getting down really at the local level, right? Especially in areas of PA. Like, and you know, when I said it in the intro about you being out in there at Cambria County and Johnstown, is like, you know, this is an area of the state that really, you know, I look back to John Fetterman's campaign, right? And said, this is one of the areas of the state where that has been left behind, right? I mean, it's one of those forgotten cities of Pennsylvania, forgotten areas of Pennsylvania that was once a boom town, right? But now has decreased. So one of the things that I'm curious about is that what's it like doing, say, progressive work or doing this kind of stuff in a place like County and PA?
Well, you know, some people told me, said, that seems like a strange place to organize for someone like Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very, you know, they have this image of it as a very conservative blue collar town. And, you know, I mean, Hillary Clinton did win 72% of the vote in here in 2008. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I thought it would be a nice challenge. Let's just see what's out there. Go and talk to people.
Yeah,
talk
and it's really
people, put advertising. Yeah.
No, and I agree. And I think that, you know, this is something that, you know, I think people are hungry for some of this kind of message. So this is the kind of thing that a lot of people don't know. So if you look at a place like Cambria County, right, people, you know, that, you know, you've got that that old cliched version of Pennsylvania where you've got Philadelphia on one side, Pittsburgh on the other side, and Alabama in the middle. Right. And so what but that narrative and that way of talking about things makes everybody think that everyone in the middle is absolutely conservative and right wing, and they don't have it. And yet in a place like Johnson, a place like Cambria County, these are the statistics, right? There are out of this. Now these are, this is from 2008, latest data that's out there, saying that there's 92,456 registered voters in Cambria County, right? And 61, almost 62% of those are registered Democrat. Right. This is not something that is kind of overwhelmingly Republican in terms of its registration. Right. And it's also been one of the most competitive counties, right, in the state. Right. I mean, you find that, you know, on the one hand, in the background, you saw that Al Gore received 50.3% of the vote, right, against George Bush. But then George Bush carried the vote the next time at a 50.8%. And you've seen these very close elections in the past. So it's like, you know, these are the folks that you're looking at. And so, you know, recently you wrote this piece that was looking at the PA primary and breaking down a little bit some of the numbers of the PA primary. And, you know, you call this piece a divergent movements in PA primary in Cambria County for Bernie and Trump. And you, as you're saying, you did organizing for Bernie on the ground there, right? Yeah. Actually doing the canvassing that's around. You found a couple of very interesting things, I thought. Like, one, you compared these two maps from 2008 and 2016. And one of the things that you found is that in 2008, right, Hillary Clinton won 55% of the vote, right? And she won, like, what, 60 of the 67 counties, right? I mean, that's huge, right? Barack Obama got 45% of the vote with only seven counties. Yet in 2016, according to what you're writing here, Sanders won 31 out of the 67 counties, right? And Hillary took it, but Hillary still won by 55%, but it was dispersed in a very, very different way. So when you're looking at those kind of numbers, what are you seeing from there? Like, from this statistical perspective, from doing this kind of autopsy on that kind of data, what does that tell you?
Well, okay. I mean, I did read like a newspaper report saying that 61,000 Republicans crossed over, like they switched their registration in the state to Republican, simply presumably to vote for Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, Trump also had a very high percentage of the vote, and there was a very high Republican turnout this time. You know, partly because it's the first time Republicans had a competitive primary here in since about 1980. And so, I mean, that was part of the reason. You know, there may have been, there was a somewhat smaller turnout. You know, we in the county here, we were able to canvass and we were able to get as many potential Bernie supporters as we could to the polls. So that, you know, that was a big reason why we won the county.
So if you're winning, I mean, so Bernie, and you say, right, I mean, Sanders won Cambria County in the primary 46.9% to 44%, right? And you said it was about 500 votes. Is that about right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, so that says, you know, I mean, in my mind, a couple of things. I mean, one, it says that, you know, the kind of message that we see from Bernie Sanders about this kind of economic populism and so on, might have resonated in ways that, hasn't to voters in these kind of areas. I mean, you know, Johnstown was once an industrial town, right? I mean, you had kind of union workers, right? There's a long history of organizing, part of the industrial economy of Pennsylvania. And from what I heard, and this is the message again that John Fetterman was arguing, is that, you know, those folks haven't had a party for a long time. Right. And to have someone come back with the kind of message of some Sanders, it makes sense that it would kind of resonate.
Yes, it does. And I mean, you know, like you were talking about, like George W. Bush being the first Republican presidential candidate, but him winning in 2004, he was the first Republican presidential candidate to win it since Eisenhower, going in the 1950s. Before that, he was the last Republican to win it. I mean, Mitt Romney did win, carry the county by a small margin 4 years ago. So, I mean, I don't really know. Well, hopefully, we'd like to think progressives can still win the county, but it depends on a lot of factors, like what happens with Hillary Clinton and what happens at the convention.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the way I think when I see this, you know, this kind of breakdown, which again, I mean, I hadn't seen this kind of close analysis really like anywhere. And this is why I just, you know, again, I love your stuff, is that when I look at that, one of the things that I can see over kind of history, and, you know, you tell me, I mean, I'm not a statistician, but this is kind of what I see in those numbers. Yeah. What I see is that, you know, especially when you're adding in, say, that was the first time that Bush had won since Eisenhower in that county. And then you've got Romney taking it. Yeah. Right? So this was also, you know, one of the, you know, brilliance, and I say brilliance in quotes because it's like horrifying in many ways, of the, you know, of what Reagan did and what a bunch of the kind of right wing Republicans did by pursuing this kind of Southern strategy coupled with a kind of almost overtly kind of racial strategy. Right. And the idea, and at the same time that they were doing that, right, the Republicans were doing that, Democrats were basically leaving behind their working class roots. Right. And I don't mean everyday Democrats. I mean the party, and then starting shifting who they saw as their constituents to kind of professionals and white collar workers. And so you've got this, you know, at one time, union workers, working class, blue collar workers were the core of the Democratic Party. And suddenly they're watching their party walk away from them. And then what's the, at the same time that their economies are crushing, these free trade deals that are coming in. And so what Republicans do then is then they start fanning the flames of racial hatred, right? They said it's not the economy, right? It's those immigrants, right? It's those African-Americans, especially for the white working class. I mean, does that gel with your experience kind of from out there in Western Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of them feel neglected by the mainstream party. And, you know, obviously someone like Trump is finding an audience here. So here and in a lot of other states. So that's what makes him so dangerous. You know, I mean, there's even a poll that came out saying that 20% of Bernie supporters might actually consider voting for Trump
in
November.
Yeah, I mean, you think about, you know, who has been the spokesperson, the loudest voices in a lot of these areas that are outside of the major metropolitan areas in the state. And, you know, you look at talk radio, you look at Fox News. I mean, that's what's replaced the kind of progressive organizing on the ground. And so these are the voices that people are kind of growing up hearing. And, you know, I always remember when I first, you know, teach at Kutztown University, and when I first started teaching there, I can't tell you how many people came to me and said, you know, they knew I did some work on global justice work and did activist organizing, this kind of stuff. And they would say things like, well, you know, these students here are very conservative. They're very conservative. They're very conservative. This is a very conservative area. And it just, like, you know, I'm not from Pennsylvania. I'm from upstate New York. And what I knew mostly about Pennsylvania was the labor history. Right? I mean, I knew that this was at the forefront of the labor movement for a long, long time. And then I looked, you know, we're like, Kutztown is about 20 minutes outside of Allentown and outside of Bethlehem, you know, the steel that built New York City. Right. And I'm like, the home of the steelworkers, you know, in Pittsburgh. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You can't tell me that these students are conservative, right? In the way that, but really it was the difference between they didn't have, you know, the sensibilities of the new Democrats is really kind of what people were telling me. But time after time again, you know, if you actually give, you know, talk to students, you work with these students, you find that, no, they're actually, you know, there's long histories of kind of, you know, progressivism, right, in their families and everything. It's just that they've got no place to go.
So yes, I agree.
Yeah, so tell me this. So then you actually, you know, we're kind of coming close up to a break, but you actually were, you know, as you said, you're doing canvassing for Bernie out there in Cambria County. What were those conversations like with just with your neighbors, you know, people down the street? You know, I mean, you guys won the county. I mean, what did you hear back from people?
Well, generally a lot of positive feedback about Bernie, and we had a lot of, you know, basically, well, the campaign had given us packets, like they had identified likely supporters. So we also, we went and canvassed amongst them. And, you know, so we obviously we did find a lot of friendly voices. So which was very heartening to hear. We also went to, say, our local semi-pro hockey team, the Tomahawks. You know, we did some leafleting there at one of their playoff games because that was like the biggest gathering of people before the primary. You know, there we ran into Trump people as well as progressives and Hillary people. So that was, you know, there we obviously, yes, we did get a lot of, I mean, we got a mix of the positive and the negative, but, you know, for the most part, it was, you know, we felt like we were on the right track.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So, okay, we're coming up to a break right now. And after the break, I'm going to ask Paul a little bit about some of the writing he's been doing about hate groups and kind of seeing if we can kind of tease out some of what kind of influence that hate groups or intersections or correlations we find between hate groups and some of the voting patterns and behaviors that we may see in this year's election. This is Kevin Mahoney, Raging Chicken Radio's The Sit Down. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1987. That was the day that Rose Will Monroe, one of the women who came to be known as Rosie the Riveter, died in Clarksville, Indiana. She was 77 years old. Rose had gone to work in a factory making B-52 bombers in Ypsilanti, Michigan during World War II. She was one of thousands of women in the United States who entered the industrial workforce to support the war effort, while more and more men entered the armed forces. While Rose Will Monroe worked at the factory, the image of Rosie the Riveter was already becoming perhaps one of the most iconic symbols of U.S. labor. The nickname Rosie the Riveter was first used in a song in 1942. The song was inspired by another real-life Rosie. Rosalind P. Walter worked during the war building Corsair fighter planes. Along with the song, a popular poster showed Rosie with a red kerchief tied around her hair, sleeves rolled up, arm muscles flexed, showing the strength of women workers. "We Can Do It" was emblazoned across the top of the poster. Then, an actor by the name of Walter Pigeon visited the Ypsilanti factory. He was helping to make a promotional film to support the war effort at home. When he found out there was a real Rosie who worked as a riveter in the plant, he recruited her for the film. The image of Rosie the Riveter lives on as a symbol of labor and women's empowerment.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie the Riveter keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little frail can do more than a male can do. Rosie the Riveter. Rosie
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Working overtime on the riveting machine when they gave her a...
Welcome back to The Sit Down on Raging Chicken Radio. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm sitting here and being joined once again with Paul Ricci. Paul Ricci blogs over at CSI Without Dead Bodies. That's right, Without Dead Bodies. So, Paul, I want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that you've been doing on hate groups and some of this analysis. I mean, when I first approached you and we were first kind of talking about coming on, is that one of the things that was standing out, I was like, I thought really interesting about these your kind of study of the hate groups and how that is kind of correlating at least with some of the stuff in the election. Mm-hmm. And this recent piece that you wrote says more hate groups in states where Trump and Clinton win. Right. I think that's kind of interesting. And so instead of me pretending that I know what the numbers are, so talk to us a little bit about what you're looking at here, what you found, and what you think is some of this kind of significance or interesting aspects of this.
Okay. Well, first, I started, say, 2 years ago, this methodology, they come out with a, 2 years ago, the Southern Poverty Law Center came out with this, with this map and its list showing, say, California, Texas, Florida have the highest numbers of hate groups. I mean, they were just reporting the raw numbers. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, they do have more hate groups, but they also have more people than any other state. So
fair enough, right?
What would the numbers look like if you adjusted for population? Mm-hmm. So I did that, and if you adjust for the population of each state plus the District of Columbia, you get a very different picture.
So when you're adjusting for population, that means number of hate groups per so many people, that kind of thing?
Per million.
Per million, okay. Mm-hmm.
Per million individuals. So, I just did that so it could be expressed in terms of whole numbers instead of fractions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, what surprised me most was technically not a state, but the District of Columbia had by far the highest concentration of groups. Mm-hmm. Which was over 26 groups per million individuals.
Yep.
So
I lived in DC for 3 years, and I know that all those folks have their offices there, and they've got their little lobbying efforts and behind the scenes stuff right there. So it does skew the numbers again, I would suppose.
Recruiting, possibly, but I'm only looking at the numbers. I haven't looked at how they, some of them were church groups and, others were, I don't know how much recruiting they did in the community. It does include groups like the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. And there's only four black separatist groups, but I'm sure they have some membership there. Mm-hmm. The other top states were the Deep South, like Arkansas, Mississippi, the states where one would probably expect there to be a high concentration.
Well, there's been that long history, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. In Pennsylvania? Yeah.
Pennsylvania was slightly ahead of the national rate. I count for when I redid the numbers this year, looking at 2015 population estimates, the national rate was 2.7 groups per million. Mm-hmm. Nationally, but it was 3.1 groups per million here in Pennsylvania. 40 groups for 12 million individuals. So that was the count. That was the Kenya. So I adjusted it, and then I thought, with all the news coming out about Trump being endorsed by David Duke and other white supremacists, I thought, let's see how do these results correlate with the primary results. And I found out indeed the states where Trump wins does have a higher concentration of hate groups.
So in addition to, say, Trump, I mean, one of the things that I think people might seem or be a little bit surprised by is that, and you also say that in the states where Clinton wins, there's a higher percentage of hate groups too as well.
Yes. So,
and it would seem that you're talking about two different constituencies there, no?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, if you look at the exit polls, the demographic profiles of the supporters of both are very different. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, of course, Trump and Clinton did win a lot of the same states. I mean, some of Clinton's biggest wins were in the Deep South, mm-hmm. and as well as Trump's. So, I mean, you know, so that's why I broke it down. I mean, of the 24 states that Clinton won, 21 of them were states that Trump also won. And, you know, it was about half and half for Bernie Sanders. So Bernie I'd have to look at the numbers, but Bernie won. Okay, Bernie won 9 states where Trump won, and he won 10 states where Trump lost. Mm-hmm. So there does seem to be a big, I guess we would say, dichotomy there.
So when you're looking at, okay, now if I put you in that role of the investigator, right? You're an investigator, you're doing the CSI thing. So now you're looking at those numbers, you're looking at those kind of correlations. And, you know, like in any CSI, you're kind of trying to pull out some sort of narrative, right? Some story about kind of what this means. So when you look at that, what's your takeaway from those numbers?
Well, I mean, obviously, looking at that in the demographic profile, I mean, mostly African Americans were overwhelmingly voting for Clinton. I mean, could be they just saw Clinton as a known quantity, and it could have been fear. Mm-hmm. Fear of these groups may be what drove, fear of these groups could, and Trump could be what drove them to Clinton.
I think that's really interesting because, you know, I look at it like this too as well. Like from my angle, when I read those numbers and I say, huh, this is interesting, right? Because, you know, I think that, you know, if you look at those numbers, people might want to take away from it and say like, oh, well, because, you know, Clinton appeals to the same people. Obviously, that's not true. It's a different constituency. But it also it offers another kind of layer of explanation about mm-hmm. the kind of strong appeal, right, of Hillary Clinton to kind of African Americans and minority groups, right, especially in those areas. So, you know, when I look at this, I see a very different analysis, or at least it adds another dimension to the analysis compared to what you see in some of the mainstream media, because the mainstream media, you know, when they look at the huge support that Hillary Clinton has gotten in the African American communities and all that, the dominant narrative seems to be, well, look, they know the Clintons better, right? They know the Clintons better. They're more familiar and that kind of stuff. And I don't doubt that. I know that's true, right? But by this is saying is like, look, you know, by seeing that the areas that she's winning big have high kind of African-American populations, especially, but also high percentages of hate groups means, you know, I look at when you have high percentages of hate groups, it's swimming in a sea, right, that supports those hate groups, right? So even though that you may not have everybody in those communities that are obviously racist, right, overt racist, right, we could say that there's certain soils that those hate groups grow in, right, more productively than others, right? And so I think about that as, you know, as another part of analysis, looking at a defensive posture, right? If I'm in a position of potentially losing something, right? If I'm in the position of, you know, of, and not just like, you know, losing an election, right? But putting myself losing a sense of safety, right? Where I'm seeing that, you know, the fans of racism are being, you know, are blowing hot and strong from Trump's mouth. So that it might make a whole lot of sense to me. I want to make sure that I'm going to get somebody in there that I think can, that I can win, right? Whether or not that, you know, bears out kind of, you know, some, what we see in some of the pollings or not. But does that gel with kind of your analysis of that same data?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, I had looked in the past, the states with more greater concentration of hate groups. I mean, they do have poor, you know, they tend to have poor health outcomes. I mean, Mississippi, that's one of the worst when it comes to poor health outcomes and higher rates of uninsured. So, yeah, the, I mean, those economic variables are correlated as well. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the bar. Larger picture. I mean, I haven't, so far I haven't looked at, I assume if I were to look at this date, the current data from the Southern Poverty Law Center and look and put it into and put it into economic data from this year, I mean, I'm certain this, a similar pattern may emerge.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So let me ask you then, I was going to bring it back home here to Pennsylvania. So no, you said Pennsylvania is kind of slightly kind of above average, right? When it comes to our, you know, the way that, you know, our soil grows hate groups, to use that metaphor again. And so if you had to kind of extrapolate a little bit from here and kind of look at Pennsylvania and you're seeing potential impact of this number of hate groups that have here, would you see any possible impact that the number of hate groups in PA or in that kind of climate may have on voter preferences when it, as we start moving towards a general election?
Possibly. I mean, I like this morning, I was just looking at a tally of the different types of hate groups in Pennsylvania. Like, I mean, you can go to the Southern Poverty Law Center and look at the hate group map for, they have a hate group map and you can look at, and you can break it down by state and they have a list of the groups they're tracking. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I did a, I mean, they didn't have it organized very well, but they did a crude, I did a crude count of all the groups. I mean, I found 9 Ku Klux Klan groups, 8 black separatist groups, which would include groups like the Nation of Islam, and let's see, 5 skinhead, 3 neo-Nazi, 3 white nationalists. I only found 1 anti-LGBT group. I mean, depending on your point of view, I mean, other mainstream religions could also be considered a hate group, depending on your, so some of this is in the eye of the beholder.
Sure, sure.
I mean, there were only two anti-Muslim groups and 2 groups they considered general hate. So, I mean, that, so yeah, I mean, it does give you a, and it shows you where these areas are, where these groups are concentrated. I mean, naturally, they are, they do tend to be concentrated around the population centers. You know, 2 of them are concentrated around Pittsburgh. Some of them are concentrated around Pittsburgh and Philly, but some of them are in the northeast of the northeastern part of the state, say around, well, Pittston, Pennsylvania, or Scranton. And, you know, like another, there's 2 groups in the northwestern part of the state around Oil City and Franklin. There are a couple around Harrisburg, like Wormleysburg. There's a KKK group, and let's see, the other one. That's a skinhead group right in Harrisburg. Let's see, I didn't. And well, there's one anti-Muslim group around Newtown, Pennsylvania. So yeah, that's a nice, they do have a nice interactive group and you can, I mean, you can look at it and see where they are.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get a link to that map and that interaction thing of the Southern Poverty Law Center too, as well as all Paul's work. So you can go check it out for yourself and read some of these statistical stuff. So I'm just really, I always find this stuff kind of fascinating. to see how it plays out. And again, I mean, think what part of what you're just saying too, as well, kind of points us in the direction that this doesn't automatically mean one thing or another, right? And we're talking about, say, hate groups that we're working with a specific definition that is not just white supremacists, like, you know, white supremacists or skinheads and things like this, but it includes the broader categories. So it's interesting to see how that is going to pull kind of back and forth. The Northeast section that you talked about, I always find fascinating too, because, you know, here's an, again, in an area of the state that is one of those areas that, you know, Fetterman calls, you know, the areas that have been left behind, the forgotten cities of Pennsylvania. And, you know, I look at, you know, in the absence of a strong labor movement, in the absence of a strong progressive movement that brings in that message of economic populism, right? You're basically leaving, like, you know, millions of people, you know, all or hundreds of thousands of people, at least across the state, kind of out in the cold, right, for someplace else to go. And, you know, the way I look at it like this is, how do we make that soil, right, a little less hospitable to those hate groups, right, and to that right-wing agenda? Because that's the same right-wing agenda that has actually been kind of separating out and kind of pitting people against each other in this state. At the same time, it's been ripping away their resources, defunding their schools, right, and kind of poisoning the environment. So, you know, that's what we could do. Well, Paul, man, I really appreciate you coming on and kind of talking a little bit about some of this stuff. And I hope to have you back. We're going to talk as you're kind of publishing things up on the thing. Look for Paul's stuff. Again, it's CSI Without Dead Bodies. We're going to get links to Paul's work in the show notes for here, and maybe we'll get some stuff of his so you can read it for yourself, right up there on Raging Chicken Press too as well. Okay. Paul, thanks a lot for taking the time and talking with us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Any help, anytime you need assistance with data, I'm available.
You got it, man. You are the stats go-to guy.
Okay.
Well, all right. You. This is Raging Chicken Radio, and this has been The Sit Down. We'll be back very soon with our little next episode. Don't forget to tune in on Tuesdays when we do our regular Out to Coop segment. That's with Sean Kitchen out there in Harrisburg. Sean has also wrote a little bit on some of the hate group stuff, particularly around Philadelphia. So maybe we'll link that in there too as well. Yes, thank you for joining us on The Sit Down. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're out. See ya.